I'm Rick Hansen, and it's August 7, 2016. September 7th, see? Really? Okay, September 7th. Anyway, and what I'd like to talk with you about is the shift into the third foundation of mindfulness, or the third establishing of mindfulness. What are we mindful of? As you probably know, we're exploring mindfulness this year in a pretty structured way. I invite you to get a copy of and take with you the handout, which usually is sitting on that table. We usually have a lot, and you know, I print up more as needed. This is a very good translation, this handout, of the, as best we can gather, the Buddha's teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness, which are a very direct, he called it the one-way path to enlightenment, a very direct, very psychological summary of practice, particularly the more contemplative or meditative aspects of practice. So that's what we're exploring this year. In the previous, the second foundation of mindfulness is about what psychologists today would call the hedonic tone of experience. The sense of it as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. I might add also the sense of it as being heartfelt, which is a very effective way to guide lizards, mice, and monkeys, as well as humans today, to avoid pain, approach pleasure, attach to others, and if things are neutral, kind of move on to something better. Right? It's very effective. There's not a problem that experiences are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Where trouble usually begins, though, is that step from the hedonic tone of experience as we tip into some kind of fear or anger or helplessness in terms of our needs for safety triggered by the unpleasant, or tip into frustration, disappointment, loss, drivenness, addiction in terms of our needs for satisfaction signaled by the pleasant, or tip into hurt, shame, feelings of inadequacy, ill will, aggression, even war in terms of our needs for connection, signaled by the sense of things as heartfelt, or spin out into dissociation, delusion, you know, entertainment, and other things in terms of things getting neutral. All right, that's the setup. So in the last several weeks, months, I think, we've been exploring different aspects of mindfulness, especially in real time, of the sense of things as pleasant, unpleasant, heartfelt, or neutral. Now, in the third foundation for mindfulness, the Buddha is drawing our attention to what happens next and to mindfulness of qualities or moods or kind of working intentions in the mind as a whole. So I want to introduce that topic, make a couple comments about it, ground it in what for me is something you could say related to it that's even deeper, and then see what you make of all this. Okay? Okay. So the Buddha, as best we know, it is said that he said, he says, where am I here? In regard to the mind, this is the third foundation of mindfulness. He's saying to us, this is what I recommend you do. He says, and how do you, in regard to the mind, abide contemplating the mind, formally and informally? Here, and I'm going to use traditional language that's here. Here, you know a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. You know an angry mind to be angry, and a mind without anger, to be without anger. You know a deluded mind to be deluded, and a mind without delusion, to be without delusion. You know a contracted mind to be distracted, a contracted mind to be contracted, and a distracted mind to be distracted. You know a great mind to be great, and a narrow mind to be narrow. You know a surpassable mind to be surpassable and an unsurpassable mind to be unsurpassable. You know a concentrated mind to be concentrated and an unconcentrated mind to be unconcentrated. And you know a liberated mind to be liberated and an unliberated mind to be unliberated. Really concise. Let's kind of unpack that a little bit. So lustful, that's a traditional term. Often it's commonly translated as greed. You might translate that as drivenness. If you think about lust or greed or drivenness, they tend to be activated related to the pleasant hedonic tone of experience or the fear or expectation of the loss of what's pleasant, with dopamine levels dropping. Anticipated reward, not coming, go get that banana. Okay? The word for anger sometimes is translated as hatred. It's our reaction to things as unpleasant for ourselves and also for others. We see something bad heading toward someone we care about or a group of people we care about or a planet we care about, right? There can be a tendency to tip into anger, quote unquote, about it, which we might also expand to include aversion or various aspects of fear, anxiety, subtle apprehensiveness, all the way to panic and terror. And also there might be a sense of helplessness, frozenness, a reactivation of trauma even, in response to the actual or threatened unpleasant. And unpleasant can be agonizing. Okay, see the structure there? So you're knowing a mind with, you know, in response to the pleasant, greedy, quote-unquote lustful, driven, including my favorite addiction, lining out items on my to-do list. Sorry, honey, I can't come. I got to finish this. No later, you know, like that. Okay. You also know mind, if your mind, if it's angry or not angry, fearful or not fearful, helpless or not helpless, aversive or not aversive. You also know your mind to be deluded or not deluded. A version of that would be ignorant, you know, out of touch, tuning out, spacing out, you know, not wanting to see, right? Head in the sand, okay, or not. And it's really fine, and it's good and useful to be mindful of or not, right? To, as he says in a different place, take gladness in your goodness. When things are going well, be aware of that too and appreciate that. I often think that positive feedback is much more informative than negative feedback. Positive feedback tells you, right there, this, bullseye. Good on you, more of that. Negative feedback just says, whoop, you didn't make it. Too bad. Now what? And you're like, well, what? You know? It's not very informative. It doesn't focus on where to really go. So it's very helpful to be aware in those little moments or in this compartment of your mind, even though there's a lot of trouble over here, but at least over here, I'm not afraid, or I'm not driven, or I'm not angry, or I'm not beating myself up right now. Because, remember, anger, aversion, reaction to the unpleasant can very often be applied to ourselves. That's a very interesting way to think about craving, isn't it? You know, attacking ourselves. Okay? Then the fourth is contracted or distracted. You can get a feeling of being contracted or just distracted or not contracted or distracted. So those are kind of four very common, I know them all, psychological states or not. All right? So those are the four first. The first four are, you know, you could say greed or lust, you know, drivenness, addiction, grasping. Second, hatred, fear, helplessness, anger, reaction to the unpleasant. Then he, you know, brings in distraction or in contraction or not. And then also delusion or ignorance or clarity. Okay? So those are kind of the four, the first four. Then he goes into, because of course he's a great yogi, and he's going all the way, and he wants us to go all the way too. I mean, he wanted those people then to go all the way too, all the way to awakening, right? Or as far along as they can. He then talks about four other kind of increasingly non-ordinary states of mind, or not. So in the first four, it's like the problem is listed first, then or not. In the second four, the good news is listed first. The aspiration is listed first, then or not. So we have a great mind or not, narrow. And great basically means a kind of expansiveness. You know, you can get that feeling sometimes when you're meditating maybe, or that you're at the beach, or you know, or you're at a memorial service, or the birth, or you're just walking by the river or something, or you look into, you know, a non-human animal's eyes, and there's just kind of an opening, a spaciousness that seems more or different than just an ordinary sense of relaxation. Then he talks about surpassable and unsurpassable. Okay, and there he's really kind of getting into some more mystical or non-ordinary states of mind. As you're, you know, if you're unsurpassable, there's really a sense of great spaciousness. Then we have concentrated, which is a code language for the right concentration pillar of the Eightfold Path. The jhana states, non-ordinary states of awareness. My own personal experience with the jhanas is like, I'm not in Kansas anymore, you know. I've experienced the first two, certainly, pieces of the second, and a third and fourth, rather. They're very profound. They're strong. They're psychologically described. There's nothing supernatural or transcendental about them, but they're like, wow. Okay. And yet they're part of the Eightfold Path. It's this Eightfold Path, not the Sevenfold Path. He's really saying, yeah, train in this, go for it. Why not? They're valuable. And then ultimately talks about fourth, a liberated mind or not. That's a mind that really has gone all the way and is fully enlightened. And sometimes what happens is we have moments or times of liberation. It's a nice saying from Tibet, sudden awakening many times a day, right? Or gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, in an upward spiral. Okay. Okay, that's kind of the roadmap. Okay, so far? Couple takeaways, and then a comment about, for me, something kind of underneath all this, and then see what you think. What the third foundation of mindfulness does is it really draws our attention to motivation, to drive, to purpose or aim. You know, where are we headed? What are called the volitions, you know, purposefulness or habits in us that have kind of an arrow to them, a directedness to them. What are we trying to do with what's unpleasant, right? Are we going to war with it? Are we blaming others for it? Are we beating ourselves up about it? What's kind of the general mood of the mind? That seems pretty useful, right? Or with regard to the pleasant, are we enjoying it, letting it come, letting it go, you know, appreciating the last taste of the glazed donut, and one is enough? I had a spiritual teacher for a while. He had a general expression. He said, one time is fine. That's a philosopher. Twice, a pervert. He meant that very loosely, but anyway. So, yeah. Or, on the other hand, are we getting into it? Are we getting about it? Are we getting possessive of what's pleasant? Are we getting upset because it's ending, as all experiences do? Are we blaming others for the fact that we don't have it? You know, are we creating trouble in our mind about it? Where are we going? So we're talking about mindfulness of kind of the motivational wallpaper of the mind in that moment. Second point is that in this form of practice, we're not trying to change anything. Maybe around this form of practice, or before or after it, we might be engaging wise efforts to reduce what's negative, or prevent it, or release it entirely. Or maybe before or after this particular practice, or kind of around the edges of it, we're trying to grow the good. We're trying to cultivate something positive through wise effort. You know, create it, protect it, increase it. All right. But the practice itself is simply a recognition, maybe with a little soft word or category in the back of your mind. Oh yeah, anger. I had a little moment there in the meditation practice, which was mainly pretty peaceful. There was a real, for me at least, a quality of peacefulness here in the room tonight. And I had watched the Commander-in-Chief Summit, so-called, with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and I was watching Hillary Clinton make some responses, and I was getting into it for her, as if I were her. Yeah, you Matt Lauer, what are you talking about my emails for? Like, bleh. And I, then, you know, then I suddenly realized what's going. I could feel my body revved up. I'm sure my pulse had started speeding up. I was caught in that little mini movie. And what the Buddha's saying right there is just notice it. Now, very often, when we just notice it, as it did for me, you know, it was like, whoa. You know, you're not sucked into the movie anymore. You're stepping back from it, right? Like, whoa. And you look at it and you go, I can't help her. I wish I could. I can't. Here I am. What I can do is meditate. Okay. You know? And you just kind of realize in the moment, it's like the bubble pops or you're no longer fueling it. And that alone can often help it change. Sometimes it doesn't, though. It's still there. You know, oh, depressed mood. Oh, such a deep longing for this pain to go away. You know, oh, so angry for the sake of others, on behalf of others. Whoa, still so angry about that. You know, you're aware of it. You're not trying to lie about it. You're not fighting it. You're aware of it. You're mindful of it. And you're kind of expanding the view in your mind. You're opening wider and wider. What's the whole of what's happening here? And in the process of that, we start observing causes. We start seeing what's going on. We start by observing them simply. More and more, we add less fuel to the problematic fires. We also disengage faster. We bounce back faster through this kind of mindfulness. Over time, we also start recognizing the beneficial states, and we just kind of don't skitter onto the next thing so fast or change the channel so quickly. It's kind of like, wait, let's go back to that one. That was a nice song. Not because we're clinging to it. It's kind of a subtle movement there, but it's like, oh, appreciating this, staying with this. Oh, I recognize this. It's like recognition. We're growing in our recognition of our moods or the qualities of our mind. And that's very, very beneficial. We're also disidentifying from, stepping back from problematic states of mind. And frankly, we're even recognizing that beautiful states of mind are just states of mind. They too have the characteristic of existence, certainly of our own experience, of impermanence. They always pass away. They arise due to causes. Anything in the natural world, you know, particularly in the mind, will pass away. Right? And there's a kind of deep peacefulness, even with that, even the most beautiful states of mind, to the extent that they're at all based upon conditioned causes, conditions, they too will pass away. Because eventually their causes and conditions will pass away. And then maybe some other sweet experience will arise, but there's a kind of growing wisdom about the whole business that takes us to a growing renunciation, frankly, in many ways, which is one of the elements of wise intention in the Noble Eightfold Path, the intention of renunciation, not pushing away or denial of the pleasures of life, but being increasingly free in our relationship to them, feeling already so full and happy, why would we chase another glazed donut, right? Okay, so that's the introduction. As a practical takeaway, mindfulness of states of mind overall, what's going on in the wallpaper of your mind, especially in the background, you know? And what are the motivational qualities? What are the aims? What are the functions that this particular moment of thought or feeling and so forth is serving? That's very useful, okay? And then I want to just sort of drop this in as, for me, a kind of a underlying truth or reality. And this teaching is implicit in the Theravadin roots of Buddhism, they're called, which is sort of the sometimes called the Vipassana stream of Buddhism. It's one I'm mainly trained in, grounded in what's called the Pali canon. Pali is the language of early Buddhism. It's a bunch of surviving teachings, a very substantial body of work. If you contrast the Pali canon, the surviving, best we can guess, teachings of the Buddha or his near contemporaries, it's books with fairly small print, about that wide. You can contrast that to the surviving words, purportedly at least, of Jesus in the four Gospels or the Quran, just for point of comparison. There's really a lot of stuff there. I don't mean it's better. I just mean there's a lot of teaching there in terms of the written record. So in that early teaching, there's a lot of emphasis on contents of mind and our relationship to them. In the movement of Buddhism into Tibet and then China and then Japan, there was a growing emphasis, sometimes called the Mahayana or Vajrayana, Zen, Chan, so forth, traditions, emphasis on the underlying ground of mind. And it gets really kind of tricky, because when you start talking about the underlying ground of mind, it's easy to start getting into, you know, metaphysical propositions or subtler forms of clinging or turning stuff into things. You've got to be careful about that. That said, it seems clear to me that any experience we're having is a momentary patterning of the underlying mental neural substrate. That's how the nervous system works. You hear a sound, you hear a cough, someone clearing their throat, you know, you glance, you see the light, a thought comes to mind. Whatever that is, that ongoing streaming of consciousness is continually represented by and constrained and conditioned by the underlying neural substrates of consciousness. There might be other causes in the mix, God, angels, whatever. What's happening locally is the result of ripples through the entire tapestry of material universe. But at least locally, it's a transient patterning of an underlying unpatterned substrate. Patterning of something that's not patterned. It's an underlying ground. And in the same way, you can experience, as your mind gets quieter and you go more into just accepting yourself as you are and being you most fully, as I was talking about here, you really start getting a sense that there is just this transient patterning. It just keeps on going. This thought, this mood, that mood, just the sensation, that sensation. Even the sense of the witnessing of it is just a patterning of it. What else could it possibly be? Just a patterning. But that which is being patterned is itself not changing. It's always available for the patterning. And you can experience that, or starting with understanding that or imagining that, and then increasingly experiencing that when you reflect on your body. You know, literally, all the atoms in your body are replaced, even in your skull. Every single atom in your skull today was not here 10 years ago. Isn't that bizarre? You know, it really is. It's true. I mean, we are even our bodies, you know, which eventually disperse. Everything's like an eddy in a stream, a ripple in a river. Even the body, which eventually disperses, is a transient patterning of material reality. You know, the sun, the Milky Way galaxy, at any scale, these are transient patternings of material reality. The material reality itself isn't changing. It's a very deep way to experience this and feel into it. If you don't relate to it, it's really okay. It very often will start conceptual. It has for me, and it's become more and more a felt recognition of just the truth of things. And how that's useful is that as you more and more take your stand in that which is not changing, that feels like and is a much more reliable basis for happiness. And as you've probably experienced, as you start to kind of sudden awakening, many moments, you know, a day, right? Moment of awakening, many times a day. You know, it's only there for a second or so, but there's a kind of bliss and peace in that sense of being the ground that is transiently being patterned. Yeah. to finish, Sri Nisargadatta, a great non-dual teacher in India, he had a, I'll just say one before I say that. One reason why that's relevant is that the Buddha's search in his life was to find that which was a reliable, lasting basis for true happiness. And one way to describe his journey, I think, in the language I'm using here, is he went from more and more sophisticated patternings. He went from being a rich kid, essentially, 2,500 years ago, to intense yogic practices, meditative attainments, bliss experiences, extraordinary experiences that I've personally never had. People I know, teachers of mine, certainly have had them. You know, he went all the way, and he kind of shrugged and went, this is it? Because every single transient patterning of his own experience, even the most exalted, always faded away. So he ultimately, he was drawn into, and this is where there is an understanding of what it means to be unconditioned or deathless, or he called it the island, that which is reliable in a sea of changes. You drop into that, and more that becomes the basis from which you live. Or, to almost finish, a little saying that, you know, that I've been fond of lately for myself is, you know, love the ripples, be the river flowing through the banks of the unconditioned. Or as Sri Nisargadatta said it, this non-dual teacher, he says, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between these two banks, the river of my life flows. All right. I wanted to bring in that last part. Okay. So that's where my head's at lately. Okay, what do you make of all that? Anything useful to talk about? Or, and again, like the Buddha said so much, see for yourself. Yeah, Lily.
Well, it's kind of a question. So when you talk about being aware of your state, whether it's good or bad, what do you do if you have something that's bad, or it's annoying you, or pain, or just something that's like it's there? So you become aware of it, but then what? I mean, it's not going away. It's
yeah.
Really good. Can't feel good about it. So what's the next step?
Right. So what do you do if it feels bad? You know, your knee is killing you. You're really upset about some argument you just had with your daughter. You know, you see someone's face on TV you don't like. You know, whatever. You know, there's no more cookies. You know, large or small, right? What do? In this practice, he says, you do nothing. You just know it. Oh, unpleasant. I was listening to a story from Temple Smith. He's a teacher in this over at Spirit Rock. He was describing being a monk, and he was in a very humorous way. I saw him on a retreat one time. He was the teacher, one of the teachers. He described being a monk in Asia as a kind of younger man, just trying it out for 6 months. And they would go on alms round in the morning, and you know, just asking for food. And it was early in the morning, and they would do it barefoot. This is Thailand or Burma, very, very poor country, and they had to walk over a lot of gravel to get to where the people were. And Temple was really upset about this. And after the second day, he went to the teacher and said, hey, what about the gravel? Can't we wear some shoes? And the teacher just looked at him and said, you know, through a translator, be mindful of unpleasant. You know, so in that, I'm not saying that this practice is good or bad, I'm just saying this is kind of what I think the Buddha said. So there is a place for just, this hurts, it sucks, what else is there? And I think implicit in it, to be able to do this, it's useful to have a spaciousness of mind, have compassion for yourself, understand why you're doing it, pull out of it if it becomes unbearable. You know, we're not designed to sit motionlessly for 45 minutes, especially as we get older. You know, just help yourself with it. But the practice itself is simply to witness it. And what's very interesting is that if you just stay with it, you know, this is something I had to learn to do because my tendency was to skitter away as fast as I could. When you stay with it, very often some interesting things happen. you notice there's a changing, buzzing, vibrating, dynamic quality to the experience itself, partly because underlying neurochemical activity is so active, so complex, you know, involving all these processes and at all kinds of scales and of space and time. And it's all buzzing in there. And usually one thing comes along, you know, another thing happens. So that's what you do in the practice. Now, over time, there are other things to do, to try to prevent the negative, to defuel it, to stop reinforcing it, do therapy about it, talk to your friend about it, realize that was then about it, whatever, and also to grow the positive. But this practice right here, it's simply to be aware of what's there. Okay. And then see how that works for you. You know, for me, it's honestly, it feels like it's expanded the space in which crud is happening. I think about throwing a bowling ball into a bucket of water. But throw that bowling ball into the ocean, you hardly notice it. You know, your mind starts getting bigger and bigger, less and less like a bucket, more and more like a pond, a lake, an ocean. Other people? Okay. Paul? Great. And then you. All right. First Paul.
Just as it pertains to the practice and sitting, the volition, the drive behind what it is, usually starts with the thought. But the intensity that is that thought is driven by the story behind the thought, for me at least.
Sure.
And that story behind the thought, like just for example, I'm sitting here during meditation and a fly lands on my arm and it's wonderful. It's like, wow, this is cool. I wonder what he's been doing all day. It's mindfulness of the body.
Keeps picking up.
And then he goes away, and then another one comes back and is on my elbow. And I go, oh, it must be his one, his brother, or maybe his brother. That's fantastic. And then one lands on my head, right? And then I'm starting to think, okay, well, let me just be monastic about this. I'm going to breathe with it, and I'm going to shoo him away with the breath, right? Right to the top of the head, and nothing, you know, that didn't work. But he flew away, and it was okay. I was okay. The second he landed on my ear, then it started really just sending stories like he's crawling in my ear, he's gonna eat my brain, and I had to move my head. I had to move. And you know, it was just something that was so negative that I had to react.
Right. So if I get it right, if I get you right there, like all that, I so relate to that.
Yeah.
You know, the fly, so forth. And question is, what I think you're getting at as well is that we can do too, Lily, that's often very useful when we recognize that our mind is tilted, you know, into lust or anger or delusion or contraction. We can ask ourselves, what's underneath that? What's driving that? What's this? Maybe there's a story under it, a kind of underlying case or narrative or a sense of being wronged or a view of one kind, or a perspective, a framing, you know, or an underlying model of relationships, right? When I feel, you know, like, okay, so that's a really useful thing to pull up. Like, what's the meaning we give things, you know? It's like fly, like meaning crawling in my ear, meaning Wrath of Khan reading, gonna take over my mind, my brain, you know? You know, like the meaning we give to it, right? The story, we don't want to, right? So yeah, then we react to it. Very real. So you can work often retroactively. And again, you have to be careful. You're not doing it to kind of do therapy on yourself in this practice. But it's really okay to sense more deeply down into what is driving this. Okay? And then Bill.
Well,
oh, good.
We need a biologist to confirm this. I learned something. It was really sweet. There's powerful implications to this. We've heard every cell in your body, it renews every 7 to 10 years. There's an exception to that. The female eggs don't change ever.
Wow.
Is there a point in that relevant to your Buddhist practice? Bill and I, we're good, you know.
Don't change.
Okay. What's that mean to you? Let's suppose it's true. I'm going to call my gynecologist friends and find out. Yeah.
I think there's an implication that's kind of sweet. Those little cells in your daughter's ovaries are never going to change.
Huh.
For example.
Yeah. I have a takeaway from that myself that might be relevant to Buddhist practice. Just who knew? I'm kidding here. But it's the idea of a standing wave. In other words, patterning. See, patterning. Go ahead, think about patterning again. You know? The contents of the wave over the boulder, you know, the particular molecules of water, dust, twigs, whatever might change, but the patterning is more or less stable. You know, the patterning roughly of my own skull has been more or less stable. I'm going to find out, because it's a fascinating question, whether the actual contents, the constituents, literally the atoms, molecules in those little eggs actually don't change. But if they did change, it would still be okay because the patterning remains, right? The problem is all patternings decay, disperse,
right.
Eventually.
Yeah. They get old.
Yeah, of one kind or another. Thoughts pass, civilizations pass. Think of civilizations as patternings, you know? Think of controversies as patternings. Think of relationships, modes of relating, including to family members. Think of those as patternings. And what the Buddha teaches, see for yourself if it's useful for you, is to grow in your non-clinging to any patterning. And one teaching, and it's a felt insight that can really support that, is to have more of a recognition of, and over time, more of a feeling for, that which is pattern. Because that which is patterned is a much more reliable basis for lasting happiness. Right? And also disengaging from our clinging to or drivenness about the momentary patternings of reality, particularly of our own experiences, can be a very powerful path for people. There's a timeout signal, Gabrielle. Well, thank you. Thank you for the timeout signal. I wish I could, talk with more people. So think about it for yourself. Love the ripples, even if they're annoying. Be the river. Intuiting the unconditioned that the river of reality flows through. How about we sit for a minute and then we'll finish up. Remembering that you too are a patterning. You too are a ripple. And loving the ripple means loving yourself too. Be well. Take care. See you next Wednesday. Oh, thank you.